Morning. My name is Brent Suddeth, and I'm an alcoholic. Huge honor for me to be talking to you guys today. My sobriety date is October 21st, 2008, so I am but a wee lad in this program, as Pete might say. And so it's really an awesome honor, especially today being the 11th anniversary of our the Breakfast Club, or at least we're close. I don't think we have that date pinned down, but it's awfully close. And so my thanks go out to you guys. I know that I have there was one time I started drinking and using when I was 16 years old. Went on for 18 years, and I know that during that time there was a stretch of 1 year where I was able to white knuckle my way through not having a drink or a drug. But I will say that I was absolutely miserable for it. I was holding my breath. I was a time bomb. I was waiting for that year to be up so that I could prove to everyone that I wasn't an alcoholic and I didn't need any help. And now I'm beyond that point, and things are different. I don't feel like a ticking time bomb. I can't take any of the credit for that myself. I tried to do it myself, and I couldn't. I needed help. I needed help from people like you. I needed God's help, although I couldn't admit it at the time. So I'll start back at the beginning. When I was 2 years old, my parents divorced. There's some interesting kind of symmetry in between my mom and my dad. My mom is the youngest of three sisters. My dad is the oldest of three brothers. They married. They divorced when I was two. They both got remarried and quickly divorced, kind of rebound marriages, and then they both remarried again, and had much longer marriages. That third time around. My mom is actually still married, and not so much for my dad, but that's why I don't take marital advice from him. But my lovely wife, Marcy, was kind enough to join us today, and she has, tomorrow is actually, believe it or not, tomorrow is our 13-year anniversary of marriage. And we dated for 5 years prior to that. So that means that she's put up with me for 18 years, which is half of my life. I'm 36 years old. Hats off to her, because she's obviously a saint for that. We are, in celebration of our anniversary, we're going to go see a play today. It's called, what is it, 39 Steps. It's something that's based on an old Alfred Hitchcock movie. It's a play, and you know, it being 39 steps, I'm very interested to see what the next 27 are all about. So, okay, that was my pitiful excuse for humor. You won't hear any more of that from me today. Okay, so, so anyways, growing up, I don't know, always. I can't point to any one particular thing that made me an alcoholic. I think I was just born that way. I really do. I can remember being very obsessive in thought as a kid. One of the things I did when I was pretty young was collecting coins. And I remember, every weekend begging my mom, let's go to the coin dealer, let's go to the flea market and see what kind of coins we can find today. And it's like every weekend just begging her, and she would complain that I was so one-track minded, and I think I was. It was very obsessive as a child. I also learned about being very secretive. I think the being raised in two different families and having to learn two different sets of rules had a big effect on me as far as trying to please other people, and trying and and compartmentalizing my life. I think I did a lot of that. My mom, growing up, there were definitely things that I wasn't allowed to do on one side, and I was allowed to do on the other. And you know, it was kind of, well, if your dad doesn't know about it, then it's okay, you know. And while that may have been okay, I translated that. I took that in and I translated it to everything. You know, if you don't get caught, then you didn't do it. You know, and that's just my, you know, it's my, I'm not trying to blame anything in my past for what I am. It's just how I am and how I translated things, how this alcoholic mind turned things around. So when I was very young, about six, I started a very unhealthy relationship, which it took me years to kind of figure out, because at the time I didn't really realize it, but it was an abusive relationship with a caretaker that was about 6 years older than me, and you know, I was just a curious kid, and she was probably also a curious kid. I was six, she was 12. And that relationship, the reason I mention it is, first of all, I went for years thinking that I was like the only one who had to deal with anything like that. And I think, you know, later in life when I was looking for reasons to justify my actions and justify why I had to drink and use, I could point to that. I could grab onto it. And I don't know, I learned in rehab. I met another guy who went through a very similar situation, and you know, after talking about it with him for a while, we realized that it didn't matter what happened when we were kids, we would have picked something that happened, and in order to justify our drinking and using. I mean, it really didn't matter. But one thing I will say about that was that it really, really reinforced the whole idea of keeping things secret. Of hiding, you know, deep dark secrets that no one can know about, and I don't know. I just grew up that way. I grew up doing my best to be different around different people. I have some relatives that live out in Cartersville, and I'm sure you guys are familiar. They live out on a farm, and you know, I don't have a whole lot of an accent. But you know, when I hang out with them, it kind of slides a little bit, and after a while, before you know it, I'd be talking just like them, and you know, we'd be talking about going down to the city and you know stuff, you know, and that's how it was for me. I'd slide into that accent, I'd slide into their mannerisms in order to get along better with them. Another thing that I did a lot as a kid, I kind of got into it pretty young, was acting. And acting for me was a huge escape. I went to a school that didn't have a football team. It was kind of a small school. And so one of the big draws there was their acting program. They had a really good director, and they actually still have a really good director, who teaches you no acting, please, which basically means that when you portray a part, you are to actually become the character. You're not up there acting the part. You're up there and you're becoming the character. And to me, that was an escape. That was becoming someone other than me. And I did quite a bit of that. So in 5 years, I did 18 plays. So that's, you know, that's sort of a testament to the obsessive nature of myself, and even before I started using and drinking. And later on, when I did finally, around 16, start experimenting with drinking, it was the same thing. It caught on. It changed who I was, changed how I felt about myself, and somehow I had this feeling that there was something more out there, you know, and that somehow I could unlock this secret world by the use of alcohol. And so I pretty much drank as often as I could. I can remember some of the first times that I drank was, you know, just I was that little kid who would go up and get a sip of beer from his dad. And alcoholism, by the way, runs in my family. Both my grandfathers on either side, one of them used to actually run moonshine back in the day, and he quit drinking after an automobile accident where his wife was injured and actually my grandmother had her voice, you could hear in her voice where the results of that accident happened. He quit drinking from that point on. My other grandfather, I don't know the specifics, but I do know that at some point in his life he quit drinking. He made the conscious decision to quit drinking. My mom, as a kid, had eating disorders, which I'm told after being through the whole rehab experience is the same type of, you know, genetic stuff can lead you to that. And my dad, while he's not really, I don't know if that I would classify him an alcoholic, but I definitely would say that he struggles with addiction. He had about 18 years ago, he had a massive heart attack, actually coded 2 or 3 times, and they had to revive him. And afterwards, they gave him 6 months to live. He's was a 2-pack-a-day smoker before then. He tried to follow their advice by changing his diet, by not smoking for a while, and he was so miserable, he decided that he would rather die with his cigarettes and happy than to lead a miserable life with no joys, was kind of the way he put it to me. And that was 18 years ago. He's still alive, so he kind of proved, what happened. So much for medical science. But anyways, he's just too stubborn. This is what it boils down to. Those are my origins. So I definitely, when I combined all this stuff from my childhood, as far as the deep dark secrets, as far as trying to be someone else to please other people, and when I mixed that with drugs and alcohol, it was inevitable. I can remember a couple of old stories. One of the first 4th of Julys, that it may have been the first 4th of July that we dated, my wife and I, was a big party held by a friend of mine, and a real close friend, but definitely someone that, you know, I ran around with looking for trouble. I just remember, he had a plastic bottle of vodka. And I just remember at some point in the night, things got crazy enough to where I was out laying on his driveway, and he had that bottle of vodka, and he was squeezing it into my mouth. And instead of doing the sensible thing of, oh, no, stop, I loved it. It was insane, but I thought, wow, this is awesome. You know, someone else is getting me completely hammered. And, you know, of course, that night, my girlfriend at the time, my current wife, was terrified because I basically was suffering from alcohol poisoning. I had wet the sleeping bag, was completely drenched in urine. I was shaking and throwing up, dry heaving, and they were, you know, this is something I don't even remember, but they were, you know, trying to contemplate whether or not they needed to call the hospital, you know, and you know, there are countless things like that happen. I suffered and continue to suffer from all or nothing thinking. I have to really today temper those thoughts with prayers because that's a lot of what what this program is about is just moderation, you know. Someone in rehab put it like, and I've heard it several times, but when you're drinking and using, life is like is up and down. It's like a roller coaster, and sobriety is a nice, steady, even plane. And I like the nice, steady, even plane. I used to think that was going to be boring and terrible, and you know, one thing that this program has given me is a big shift in perspective. It's probably one of the biggest things that it's given me. Before I came into this program, my grandfather was a deacon, the one actually who used to run Moonshine was a deacon in the Baptist church, and so we went to church pretty regularly. I guess he was making up for his wild days, you know, and. So we went to church pretty regularly as a kid, and I don't know what happened. I really don't. I know that at some point along the way, I kind of rebelled. I kind of said, why are we doing this? What's the point? You know, this was around the time when all the stuff was coming out about, you know, Tammy Faye and Jim Baker and all this, you know, and I had all these reasons to point to. I could point as far back, you know, like it says in the big book, I could point as far back as the Crusades and say, ah, see what God does for man, you know, it's, you know, and so I had all these reasons not to believe in God, and I really firmly believed that man created God and not the other way around. I was, you know, I think I saw some value in religion, but I couldn't make that leap. I couldn't make that leap of faith for myself. I sort of envied people who could, because they seemed so much more content. And I didn't understand how they could fool themselves like that, you know? And I was just such a cynic. You know? It's like that dyslexic agnostic who sits up till the wee hours of the morning contemplating the existence of dog. That's really deep, sorry. So anyways, one of the hugest gifts that this program has brought me is faith, is a belief in a higher power. And it had to be termed to me this way, I think, because of my very rebellious nature, and because I didn't like to have authority tell me how things were, that this program had the answer for me. It had a God of my understanding, which, I mean, that key phrase there was everything to me in discovering spirituality. When I left high school, went off to college, that's when things really erupted as far as my drinking was concerned. I started dealing pot, and my drinking escalated, as did my drug use. I tried everything I could get my hands on, is what it boiled down to. There were maybe I can only remember one time in my existence that someone offered me a type of drug that I'd never had before, and I turned it down. I mean, so that's pretty sad when you think back on it. I do remember going to Georgia, I was not a football fan when I went there. I went there and was working at Longhorns and would work game days, and it was not a problem for me because there was alcohol there, and so that made working in a restaurant really cool. You know, towards the end of the night, magically, a pitcher of beer would show up back in the kitchen, and it would just slowly disappear. No one asked any questions. No one carded anybody. But later on, I got in with some friends who were big into Georgia football, and it, to me, became my religion. It became the reason to get up on Saturday mornings and start drinking. And so it was also, however, a huge point of contention between my current wife and myself at that point. We kind of fell into this terrible routine to where we would have horrible fights on Saturday night after the game, and you know, make up on Sunday or Monday with tears and you know, apologies and promises about, you know, being better and doing better in the future, and then the next week start the whole cycle over again. Anyone who has battled with addiction knows that it's very cyclical in nature, and it was a terrible cycle, you know, to be caught in. It continued on and on. I do remember one of the days after I think it was after a loss, a Georgia loss. It would make the only sense that it could make. It was a day game. We got very, very drunk going in. We snuck liquor into the place. We lost the game, and Brent took off on his own. That sometimes is what I would do. And I remember wandering into a bar, stumbling into a bar would probably be a better description. And the next thing I remember was being escorted out by the two bouncers because Brent had decided to take a nap on the bar, and they didn't think that was a good idea. So in my blind stupor, I was walking towards the apartment where my buddies were waiting for me, I'm sure, and I knew I wasn't going to make it. I had forgot to use the facilities before leaving the bar that they escorted me out of, and so I decided, you know, it'd be a good idea. I could just duck around the corner here, relieve myself, and be on my way. So I ducked around the corner, relieving myself, and I get tapped on the shoulder by one of Athens' finest. Little did I know at the time, the corner that I happened to duck around was the downtown Athens Police Department. So, not a very observant drunk. My buddies, who were probably just, well, maybe a shade less drunk than I was, were called and actually drove down to pick me up. And for some reason, I guess, you know, game day in Athens is quite a spectacle, and you know, the cops had plenty of things to worry about, and they figured they knew the address that I was going to, and they knew it wasn't very far, so I guess they let us slide. I should have been in jail. I should have been in accidents. I drank so much from the time I was 18 to 21 that I very, very seriously considered giving up alcohol then. I knew even at that time that it was a problem for me. Of course, the solution to that problem for me was another substance. You know, it wasn't going clean and sober. That wasn't the idea for a long, long time. I went on pretty much doing the same old thing. In college, my buddy and I started a contracting company, painting mostly to start with, and we did, you know, deck building, and we mostly turned apartments. It was Athens. There were a lot of kids coming in and out, and we would turn apartments that was our big cash crop. And that lifestyle left me all the freedom I wanted to drink and use the way I wanted to. And we did that for probably 5 years or so. Eventually, I got to the point. There's a Dave Matthews song with the lyrics, 23 and so tired of life, such a shame to throw it all away. And that really embodied, because there was a time when I just felt like my life wasn't going anywhere. You know, I was mid-20s, stuck trying to chase a degree that I didn't really want, you know, trying to get a piece of paper that I wasn't going to use, and drinking more and more. You know, it went from a six-pack a night to a 12-pack a night to a case a night on the weekends, and it was, you know, it was just out of control. Yeah, so eventually those thoughts, you know, I was dealing drugs, so I had a lot of paranoia. I had a lot of worry all the time. It seemed like, you know, I could drink or use to get rid of these feelings, and then they'd come back twofold at the end. It was a terrible cycle. Somewhere in all that, the depression finally kind of got to me. I kind of realized that this wasn't the way that I wanted the rest of my life to go. And so I started looking around for options. The business hadn't taken off quite the way we had planned. It seemed like any time we found someone who was interested enough to work for us, that we would, you know, lend them cars and equipment to go do jobs. And one guy in particular had a bad habit of going to the pawn shop for crack money, you know, which just seemed like we were drawing the same kind of people that we were, you know, and they were not to be trusted with our business. And so anyways, my girlfriend at the time was going to nursing school. I had always been kind of a science guy, and I don't know, from hanging around with her, seeing her study groups, it sounded interesting to me, you know. And when I initially went to college, I had planned on being pre-vet, so all that stuff was pretty interesting. What I wound up getting was a psychology degree. When I finally boiled down to, you better get something and go, and that was the piece of paper I got, and it lent itself nicely to a nursing program. I think I took one more quarter of courses, and I had all the prerequisites. And I went ahead and applied to nursing school, got engaged to be married, decided I was changing the course of my life. Went through all that great, decided very early in nursing school, as soon as I realized that there was something called a nurse anesthetist, that really, you know, piqued my interest. It seemed like, well, that's the guy who puts you to sleep. He's the one who gives you all the drugs when you're having surgery. And I just thought, wow, you know, I can draw on my experience as a drug dealer and become a legalized drug dealer. You know, it seemed to make sense to me, you know. A drug dealer with a license, you know, who would have thought it? So that's the way I went. I went through with nursing school, got out of the business. Worked for a year at St. Joseph's. Went and you know, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I was always planning to go down that road, even though I knew it was not the thing to do. 'Cause throughout all this, I was still drinking and using. Got accepted to an anesthesia program up in Pittsburgh. Moved up there. Thought it would be a great geographical cure. Get away from all those party guys, get away from my weed connections. I had quit dealing at that point, and I could go up to Pittsburgh and concentrate on my studies and make something of myself. That is when I really learned that I was an alcoholic. There are three different times that I went to Alcoholics Anonymous to start with. First time was as a nursing student. And as an observer, and I thought, man, these poor guys, I mean, I sure would hate to be in their shoes, right? next time was in Pittsburgh. Being that I had no other substance to quiet the noise in my head, to take away that feeling of a ticking time bomb, I fell in really, really heavy with drinking. Hiding bottles around the house, drinking vodka. That was it was really, really bad. And I had a very good work ethic. I think that I missed, when I worked for Longhorns, I missed one day of work there due to the alcohol. And then I missed one day of clinical as due to alcohol in Pittsburgh. And that was my my second introduction to AA. My wife kind of gave me an ultimatum. She said, you know, I can move back home if that's what needs to happen. And I said, no, honey, I'm going to fix this. We're going to get this all worked out. So I went to AA for, I don't know, I promised to try it for maybe 6 or 7 times, something like that. We drew up contracts. We made promises. And I decided that AA wasn't for me because of this big G-O-D word on the wall that scared me half to death. Graduated. That was when, by the way, the year that I managed to white knuckle it. That was after that point. I gave up, didn't use anything for a year, and was, you know, once that was over, it was just very quickly within 9 months of that year being over, I was drunk in public at a wedding function with my pregnant wife. And, you know, and thinking, how did this happen? You know, I thought I had this all under wraps. And so, you know, the answer then was just, you know, it was switching substances again. I had to try to keep finding the right combination until things worked out. My daughter was born a little over 4 years ago. I think that was the first time I truly wanted to change things, because I wanted to be a good example for her. But I couldn't do it. I felt I could go for a little while and feeling miserable, feeling terrible, before I would use or drink again. And it was never anything good that came out of it. Not exactly sure why I made the jump, but at some point I knew alcohol wasn't working for me. Marcy could, she'd been around me long enough to be able to tell when I'd been smoking. So those things weren't, I couldn't hide my use well enough anymore. I decided I'd try something different. Being in anesthesia, those drugs were readily available to me. You don't necessarily give all of what you pull out of the Pyxis to your patient. And so I was kind enough to soak up the excess. And that was a very slippery slope. I kind of, in a way, I really am kind of thankful that it came to that for me, because it got me here a lot quicker than alcohol would have. I think I could have banged against my head against the wall for another 10 years pretty easy. You know, trying to if I hadn't have made that leap. I don't know what it was. I think it was desperation. I think it was a cry for help. I knew I was crossing a line that I shouldn't be crossing. Eventually, you know, first of all, it was just a, you know, I justified it. There was a lot of justification in my head of, well, you know, alcohol is completely out of the question. I can't handle that. Marijuana stays in your system for 2 weeks, so I'm worried about passing drug screens. And, well, wait, if I use this other stuff, it's out of your system in 2 or 3 days. That means I'm only dirty at work for, like, one day out of the week. I can party on the weekends, and everything will be cool. And that worked for a couple of weeks, and then it became a daily thing. And then I was trapped. And it became the most physical necessity that I've ever felt before. and it was no longer a question of getting high. It was just a question of trying to feel normal, and that's all it was. But it was so hard to let go of. It took me getting caught several times before I was able to decide in my true self that I was done. My wife caught me a couple of times. I tried to play it off, say it was, you know, I was just trying it or make it up, any whatever BS I thought she would buy. And eventually I tried to get some outpatient help. She begged me to go to rehab, and I wouldn't do it. When I was in nursing school, I worked as a mental health associate in a rehab center in Athens, and I knew what that was all about, and I wasn't interested. And I was better than that, I guess. And so I went for some outpatient help. They put me on this stuff called Suboxone, which is an opiate agonist antagonist. And in my eyes, kept tickling receptors that didn't need to be tickled, you know, because I wasn't clean. I was still putting something in my system that I had to put in. I could tell when I didn't have it. It definitely changed the way I felt. What finally did it for me was getting caught at work. After one relapse, the second relapse that I had after trying to get help, I finally got caught at work with an IV in my foot, basically passed out on a bathroom floor in a hospital after a shift, and you know, that my boss said, "You got to go to rehab. We'll save your job for you, but you got to go to rehab and get help." That was the beginning. You know, I finally had hit that bottom. I just remember that first night in rehab. Right before I went to sleep, I felt like the world had been lifted from my shoulders. I mean, despite how terrible everything was leading up to it, I finally felt like, I can quit pretending. They're gonna help get me clean, and I can live the way I should live. That's when I finally opened my mind, and that was my third entrance into AA. Because in rehab, you know, first night there, what do we do at 8 o'clock? March on down, hit the AA meeting, you know. And I was just like, as soon as I realized what it was, I was like, this again, huh? Okay, all right, I give. I'm gonna give it a try. And God for me was very early. I mean, group of drunks, good orderly direction. Good orderly direction made the most sense to me. And eventually I could make the leap and just say God. I mean, there was definitely probably, you know, 6 months there where I couldn't really say God and mean it. I was all wrapped up in old images and old thoughts about God. I mean, the truth is that God's just a word. It can't fully define my higher power. Nothing can. I was in Ridgeview for 14 weeks. I came out. My boss kind of did me a favor, but he was trying to do me a favor, I'll say that. But in hindsight, it probably wasn't the best of things for me. This I was told by my nursing group at Ridgeview. They very strongly suggested that I not go back into work. But I did, and within 5 weeks, I had relapsed on nitrous oxide, which, you know, it's one of those things that's readily available in a hospital when you're working nights alone. I managed managed to convince me that that wouldn't count. I had while in rehab, it's kind of funny. I on the way into rehab that morning, I stopped, and I wasn't, especially then. I was never really a huge smoker, but then I definitely wasn't. But I decided I was going to be smoking in rehab, because what else are you going to do in rehab? And so I bought two cartons of cigarettes going into rehab, and within the first week of dealing with the withdrawals from the opiates that I had been on, I felt so absolutely sick and miserable that I probably only got through maybe two packs of those cigarettes. I quit smoking. I felt like, okay, this is a sign I should quit smoking, and wound up, you know, selling those cigarettes in rehab at a cut price, just to get rid of them. I don't know. The point of it was, oh, and then, okay, so I had sworn off cigarettes then. Well, I finally broke that. I finally, after, it was getting real close to when the twins were being born. And we were supposed to have a C-section on the 8th. 8-8-0-8 was the date. And then Eli decided to turn at the last minute, because they were both breached. Eli decided to turn, and we were going to be sent in on a Tuesday instead of Friday to be induced. And I don't know why, but I broke. I just said, I can't handle this, and I need a cigarette. And looking back, that was the beginning of my relapse, because I was hiding it. I didn't tell anyone about it. I didn't tell my wife about it, and I hid it. And it just was, it was slipping back into my old ways and old thinking. Today, honesty is absolute keystone for me in my recovery. I have to try to live transparently. When I did come back in and pick up my white chip after losing my job, I went into another meeting, I think maybe the Canton group or something like that, went in to pick up my white chip, and they didn't have any white chips. So some very creative person punched out the bottom of a styrofoam cup for me and wrote the letters AA on it. And so this is my actual white chip for my sobriety. What I love about it is that it's imperfect and it's very fragile, just like my recovery. I don't have to be perfect today. All I have to do is work each day on spiritual growth. The gifts of recovery are countless. I live in gratitude today, whereas in the past I was not grateful for anything. I took everything for granted. Today I've got three beautiful kids, beautiful wife, wonderful family. God has taken care of me. As soon as I lost my job and I was in huge fear, and it was that push I needed to make the spiritual leap of trusting God and putting my life in God's hands. When I did that, amazing things started happening. God took care of me in ways that I would not have ever thought possible. And he's allowed me to spend a lot of time at home, taking care of the kids. I've been able to paint my house. I've been able to do some amazing things. And I don't know, the best thing is that I'm happy about coming to AA today. I love to come to these meetings. I go to about five a week. I take a drug called naltrexone, which is an opiate blocker. I do that because of suggestions that my addictionologist makes to me. I'm in a program where I meet with a group of nurses in recovery once a week. I meet with an aftercare group once a week. I know today that anything I put ahead of my recovery, I will lose. I take that very seriously. I know this is life and death, And I think that's all I have to say about that.